Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Tzadihei Amun Aleph by the Mishnah. Mishnah says, Mishaya Nasui Bet Nashim, person was married to two women, Umachar et Tzadehu, and he sold his fields. We're assuming here that his fields are encumbered to the Tubot, meaning that each of the women that he's married to have a Tubah, and their Tubot have liens on his property, because that's the nature of the Tubah, that all of his property is encumbered to the Tubah. But he sold the field. So when he sells the field, the buyer of that field knows that the women are creditors on that field, and if they come to collect their Tubot, meaning that he predeceases them, then they will have rights to take that field away from him. So he enters into an agreement with one of the women, and it says, V'kadva rishona, the first woman, meaning the woman has a tubah with the earlier date, the earlier creditor, enters into an agreement with the lokeach, with this purchaser, dinu dvarim ein li imcha. I don't have any issue with you, meaning that I have no claim against you. So the first woman cedes her right to come after this property in the event that there's no other property for her to collect her tubah from. She cedes her right to that property, and therefore the buyer is secure, at least with regards to the first creditor. Then the husband passes away. Hashniya, the second woman, who has the later dated tubah, motziah me'alokeach, she doesn't have any agreement with him, and therefore she has a right to take that property to fulfill her tubah in order to pay off her tubah. But once this woman, the second woman, takes the property, Rishona minashniya, the first woman now can extract that property from the second woman. Because over there, she has no agreement with the second woman. And since she's the primary creditor over here, because she has the first dated tubah, she has a right then to extract the collateral that was taken by the second woman and then take it for herself because she's a primary creditor. Valokeach, but then once the first woman takes it, the buyer can go back to the first woman and say, okay, Achmen Rishona. He can take it back from the first woman. He says, we have an agreement that you're not allowed to take this field. So now that you have the field, I want the field back. So then the buyer takes the field back. V'chozrot chalila. And then the second woman can take it, becomes a iterative cycle where every time they just keep going around and around and around, and there's no solution to the problem. Ad shiyasu pshara b'nehem, until they come to some monetary agreement between them. Since nobody has the primary rights here, everyone's rights is subordinated to another party in the circle, then they've got to come to some sort of meaningful agreement monetarily in order to stop this process of each one of them collecting the field from the other party. So a number of things here. One important thing is something that we discussed in yesterday's daf. Rav Nachman came to the conclusion that when you are a secondary creditor and you go ahead and grab property before the primary creditor, the Gemara discussed whether Masha Gava Gava or Shlo Gava. We concluded, Rav Nachman concluded yesterday, that Shlo Gava, it doesn't work. Now that's clearly what this Mishnah says. This Mishnah clearly says that when the second creditor goes in and takes property before the first creditor, then you can go and extract them property from that creditor. The first creditor here has a right to go and grab it back from the first creditor, and Masha Gava, Lo Gava. So all the Rishonim ask, why did the Gemara have a question? Gemara never brought this Mishnah down, but this Mishnah is pretty explicit that you can go after the second creditor if you're the first creditor, and we don't just say, Masha Gava Gava. Why would you have a Machoket Amoraim, and why doesn't the Gemara bring this Mishnah as definitive proof to that? So all the Rishonim have to come up with ways to explain this Mishnah that it doesn't exactly fit that case, meaning using Ukimtot, whether you say that it is an Apotiki, it was a directed lien in this case on the property, and that's why it's not subject to the normal rules of Masha Gava Gava, Masha Gava Lo Gava, or because of other circumstances that the Rishonim come up with in order to establish that this case does not match the case that the Gemara was discussing, because otherwise it's a little strange that the next Mishnah they don't bring as proof to the fact that Masha Gava Lo Gava. Now the Mishnah continues and says, V'chein Bal Chov, V'chein Isha Balat Chov. The same is true in a case of a creditor, and the same is true in the case of a woman who is a creditor, which would be usually a woman who's holding a tubah. And the Gemara in the end will discuss what's the case here that is differentiated from the case in the Reisha. The Reisha case is where there are two women who are claimants against the estate of the husband. In this latter case, there are actually two buyers, which is what the Gemara is going to set it up. There are two buyers that purchased the property that had the lien on it. And then the creditor has an agreement with one of the parties, and then he goes to extract the half of the value of his loan, or their ketubah, from the other party, the other buyer. And by doing so, once they take that property, then the other buyer can go ahead now and demand that the second buyer give them the property, because when they bought the property, they bought it with recourse. And so therefore, you have the same circular problem that we have here will also be in this case. Again, that'll be the last thing that the Gemara discusses in the Perek. We'll discuss it then, set up exactly what the case is. Correct. In these cases, it's obvious that there's no other property to collect from, because if there was free and clear property for them to go after, we would demand that they go after the free and clear property before the encumbered property. And obviously, there's no other party who has a lower right over here, because it was someone who came after the buyer, or someone who came after the creditors, then obviously there'd be a different view over here, because then you could go after that party that had the lower rights. Okay, v'chi katvale my havi. Once the woman writes this statement of dinu dvarim en li'imcha, is that sufficient to relinquish her rights of collection? Since when does that work? So now the Gemara is asking this on two levels. Number one is, how is this effective? And number two is, even if you come up with a methodology to make it effective, the Gemara will ask a secondary question is, does it work anyway? So, first of all, just because a woman says something, how is that binding? Don't you usually need a kinyan for something to be binding? So that's number one. Number two is, even if you make a kinyan, does it work? So that question is at both of those levels. V'atanya, don't we have a braita? Omer lechavero, someone who says to his friend, dinu dvarim in li elsa dezu, I have no claims against this field. Vainly esek ba, I have no dealings with it. V'yadi misuleket emenu, my hands are removed from it. Lo amar klum, that type of language does not work, whether it's because it's a deficit in the language itself, you're trying to relinquish ownership in a case where you have ownership already, or if it's because you're just saying something that has no binding force to it. Either way, it doesn't work. And that's exactly what the woman did here. She just said, dinu dvarim, I don't have anything to do with this. But that's not sufficient. So Mar says, achav ma'eskinan, v'shekano miyada. They have a kinyan. They made a kinyan which formalized this agreement between them. And therefore, the kinyan is what allows this to be effective. The Gemara says, v'chidkanu miyada ma'havi. So here's the secondary question. Okay, you figured out the way to make it effective, kinyan. But even with a kinyan, does that help? Does this type of language, this type of relinquishment of rights, does it really become effective? Tema, this woman should be able to say, Nachat ruach asiti lebali. I was just making my husband happy. Milotnan, don't we have a mishnah that a woman has such a claim? Even if she agrees to do such a thing, she has this in her back pocket, which is, she can say, I didn't do it because I really wanted to sell you this right. I just did it because I didn't want to create a quarrel within my house. Now, normally with such a declaration, or you want to say to someone you did something quote-unquote under duress, you have to make a declaration beforehand to Edim. You have to make some sort of disclosure beforehand that I'm not doing this because I want to. I'm being forced, or there's other reasons, other variables that are causing me to do this. In this instance, it seems like that you don't have to do it, and the circumstance itself makes us anansade. It's clear to us that a woman who's married will tend not to argue with her husband or tell her husband no when he goes in and sells the property. So even though she has a right of veto, the fact that she doesn't exercise it isn't proof of the fact that she really wants this transaction to go through. Because if she vetoed it, that would cause a breakdown in their relationship. So now she always has this claim, which is the reason that I acquiesced over here was because I didn't want to upset my husband. Milotnan. Don't we have a mishnah? Lakach min aish. He purchased it from the husband. V'chazar v'lakach min isha. And then he goes and he pays the woman. Not that he pays her the full amount of the field again, but he's basically paying her to remove the lien. like you would do with any creditor, if you want them to waive their rights, either to a lien on a property or to other rights that they have in this instance, so you pay them money to release whatever those requirements are. So it's the same thing over here. He purchased the field from the husband, and then he goes to the wife and says, I want your lien off this property. I'm going to pay you to remove the lien from the property. Mecho batel. It doesn't matter. The transaction with the woman is null and void, because the only reason she agreed to that transaction is, again, to make sha'um bayit, or is to give nachat ruach to her husband. Almo, what do you conclude from this? Yochol hi sh'te'amer nachat ruach asiti l'bali. She has this right of claim that she can say that the only reason I agreed to this, the only reason that I sold the rights to you is because I didn't want this to cause friction in our marriage, but not because I really wanted to sell it. So in our case as well, why can't you say the same thing in our Mishnah? That she can say, even though she said din dvarim and she relinquished her rights to the field, she wasn't serious about that. She did that to please her husband, not because she really wanted to do it. So I'm Rabbi Zeira, I'm Rav Chista, lo kasha. That's not a problem. Ha, Rabbi Meir, ha, Rabbi Yehuda. Depends on which Tana we are following. The Tanya, we have a Braita. Kot of the Rishon, velo chatmalo. The husband sold the first field to an individual, and the woman refuses to sign on to this or release her lien from the field. Lishini, then he sells it to a second party, or sells a second field to a second party. Vechatmalo, and then she signs on that. Ibda tubata, she loses her tuba. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says she loses her tuba from both parties over here. The first purchaser who comes to purchase the land, she didn't sign off on that. So in a sense, she did not release her lien from that first property. But the first buyer can say, I left sufficient property after me. And this is the case by any time you have liens on the property. The first buyer can say, I left behind free and clear property for you to collect your ketubah from. So now, when I buy this property, you can't come to me first. You got to go to the second buyer of the property, because his property or his purchase is subordinated to my purchase. And since it's subordinated to my purchase, you can't come to me first. You got to go to that other player. Well, with the other player, she can't go after him because she signed off on that sale. Since she signed off on that sale, she can't get it. For that reason, she loses her right to collect the tuba from either one of the properties. From the second property, because she agreed to the sale. From the first property, because the first buyer can say, I left you enough room to collect from the second buyer. You can't come to me first. For that reason, she loses out on both. Now, the reason behind Rabbi Meir's position is the fact that she refused by the first sale to agree to the sale and agreed to the second sale shows that she has the capability of vetoing. Since she has the capability to veto, when she goes ahead and then agrees in the second case, that's why it takes force or takes effect. Because she can't make a claim, oh, I just want to make my husband happy. If you wanted to make your husband so happy, you would have agreed to the first sale. The fact that you vetoed the first sale already shows that you have the ability to refuse your husband. And the fact that you didn't do it in the second case means that you really wanted to sell it in the second case. And that's why Rabbi Meir says you lose your rights here completely. Yeah. Again, all these cases are cases where he has no other property from which he can collect. Otherwise, obviously, we'd go after that property. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Yecholahi Shuteamer, Nachat Ruach, Asiti Debali, Atem, Malachem Alai. The woman can say, I only agreed to the sale because I wanted to make my husband happy, and therefore you have no claim against me. What Rabbi Yehuda is saying is Rabbi Meir has a good claim. She vetoed the first sale. She vetoed the first sale, then by agreeing to the second sale, she really can't say, oh, I want to make my husband happy. She clearly, in the previous case, was willing to veto it. What Rabbi Yehuda basically says is, well, I already used up my veto right. I already got him upset when I vetoed the first case. For me now to come and veto the second case will make him really angry. So therefore I was compelled to agree in the second case because I can't keep vetoing all the sales over here. And so she can make such a claim that I was really trying to please my husband despite the fact that she already vetoed the first case. She can say, you get one veto right and I can't keep getting rights of veto afterwards. Virabi. Now here you can read this line one of two ways. You can read it as a statement of fact, or you can read it as a rhetorical question, which is, Rabbi, Satam Lahacha Rabbi Meir. Over here, Rabbi made the Stam Mishnah our Mishnah like Rabbi Meir, which is that once she sells her rights, she has no ability to say that I was just making my husband happy. Because over here in our Mishnah, once she gives up that right, we say that that's a good agreement between them. And she can now not say, oh, I was just making my husband happy. Versus V'satam lahatam ki Rabbi Yehuda. And the Mishnah that we brought from Gittin, over there, that's according to Rabbi Yehuda, who says she can say that I sold it just to make my husband happy, and it's not a real sale. So you can either say that as a statement of fact. We're explaining the difference here between the Mishnah here and the Mishnah in Gittin is because there's different authorship. This is authored by Rabbi Meir, and that is authored by Rabbi Yehuda, and we saw the difference in their opinions. So that's one way to read it. The other way to read it is that the Gemara is unhappy with this, and saying, why did Rabbi make the authorship in Ketubot, according to Rabbi Meir, and the authorship in Gittin, according to Rabbi Yehuda? But there's no reason for him to give a Stam Mishnah like this and a Stam Mishnah like that. We have other cases, like in the Gemara in the beginning of Beitzah, where we said that in some places, Rabbi was Sotem ke Rabbi Shimon, and other places he was Sotem ke Rabbi Yehuda, and they're machloket about Muksa. But over there, the Gemara explains why. He says, by Yom Tov, where everybody's Mekel, he said, Allah should be like Rabbi Yehuda, and we're more stringent by Muksa. And by Shabbat, where the laws are more machamur, over there he was Mekel like Rabbi Shimon. But there the Gemara explains why he would have a difference of opinion in Shabbat and Yom Tov. Over here we haven't explained why he would subscribe to Rabbi Meir over here and Rabbi Yehuda over there. And in essence, we're talking about the same case. So therefore it's a question of the Gemara. Why would he have a differentiated opinion when we don't have an explanation for that? So Amar Rapapa, Rapapa solves the problem and says, Bigrusha, Bidivri Akol. Our case here is a case where he divorced her. So yes, he sold it maybe while they were married. But now her lien on the property exists because they got divorced. When they got divorced, she has a right to collect her ketubah. She is a creditor. And by being a creditor, she has a lien on this property. So then he comes and buys the lien off of her, removing her lien by purchasing it from her. She can't claim I was trying to make my husband happy because they're divorced. They're not married anymore. So that's the way Rav Papa solves the problem. Rav Ashi Amar Kula Rabbi Meir Hi. Rav Ashi says that everything over here is Rabbi Meir. All the Mishnayot are authored by Rabbi Meir. V'ad kan lo kama Rabbi Meir hotam elo v'shnei lukuchot. If you notice, there was a slight difference between the Mishnah we quoted in Gittin and the Braita where we quoted the opinions of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. The Mishnah in Gittin is talking about one woman who, after her husband sold the property, went ahead and granted the person rights, sold alongside of her husband her rights to the property. And over there we say it doesn't work. The Braita talked about a case where there are two buyers, and the woman only agreed to the second buyer. And what Rav Ashi says is that's what makes all the difference here. The reason that Rabbi Meir says in the case of the Braita that she cannot back out and said I'm doing it just to make my husband happy, so that's why her release was considered to be a release according to Rabbi Meir. And that's what Rav Ashi is describing over here. That you can differentiate, even within Rabbi Meir's opinion, you can differentiate depending on the case, which is, Ad kan lo kam Rabbi Meir hotam elo b'shnei lukuchot. The reason by the Braita that he says that the woman can't back out of her sale of her lien or removal of her lien is because there were two buyers there. Damri la iita denachad ruach avat lekamo ibayalach lemevad. Because if you really were trying to please your husband, you would have also released your lien to the first buyer. By the fact that you didn't release it from the first buyer indicates that you're really serious about the release to the second buyer. Aval b'lokeach echad, if there was only one buyer, afilu Rabbi Meir modeh, even Rabbi Meir would agree that in that case where she agrees to release her lien, she's only doing that to please her husband, because she doesn't indicate otherwise that she doesn't want to please her husband. We don't have any other evidence that shows that she will veto in these cases. If we have evidence she would veto and she didn't veto this case, that shows that she really knows when to stand up to her husband, and when she agrees, she really meant to agree. But when you have one lakuach, you only have one buyer, and she agreed, that doesn't show us evidence of how she would act in a case where she didn't want it. Umatznitin, and you'll have to explain our Mishnah, the cut of lei l'acher, in a case where this is already the second sale, where you have to say that in this case where she says, dinet varim inli imcha, I have no issues with you, I'm not going to come after you, I'm releasing the lien from the property, that's already the second buyer, and she had refused an earlier buyer. That's not explicit in the Mishnah, that's an ukimta. Now she's making an order to have it be binding, to have her statement here be binding. It's not hotom. We have a Mishnah over there. Ein nifraim minichasim mishubadim, B'makom sheyesh nechasim b'nei chorin, v'heilu ein ziborit. So this is the principle that we spoke about at the end of the Mishnah. It's a principle that we mentioned all along, that a person is not allowed to go after encumbered property when there's free and clear property still left in the estate, even if the quality of that property is lower than the quality of the property that's being held by the parties that purchased. As long as there's free and clear property left behind, then the creditor must go after that free and clear property. There's no rights to go then and take it back from buyers or take it back from primary creditors, because you have the ability to collect without, in a sense, upsetting the apple cart, without causing problems. Now, that could be for one of two reasons, which will be important over here. Who is the takana helping out? Is the takana helping out, in a sense, the buyers who have claims against the estate because they purchased from the estate with recourse? So we're helping out the buyers, that we say that if buyers go in and buy something, as long as they leave sufficient property behind them to fulfill all of the debts of this individual, then they will not be held accountable, that they know the creditors can't come after them. So that's what I call takanat ha-shuk. In order to facilitate purchases of properties, where people know that if they purchase the property, they're not going to be all of a sudden have creditors come after them, they say, I left sufficient room for the creditors to collect from the property. When I bought it, you can't come after me. You got to go after that property first. That'll be both from the perspective of its free and clear property, as well as the subsequent buyers, their rights will be subordinated to the first buyer because he left sufficient room behind. So that's one reason we could say it, that we did this because we wanted to help the liquidity in the markets and allow people to buy things without having these fears. So in order to do that, we said you always have to go after the free and clear property. That's one reason you could say the takana is in place. The other reason you could say the takana in place is, when we don't hurt the creditor, then we will protect the buyers. If we hurt the creditor, we're not going to protect the buyers. Over here, the creditor will get his collection. Since he will get his collection, and the buyers will be able to keep their property, and the creditor will get his loan fulfilled, then we'll let this stand. We'll tell him he's got to collect from the free and clear property. In a case where the creditor will be hurt by us protecting the buyers, over there we won't do that. So that's one of two possibilities as to how this takana works or why it's in place. Is it in place to facilitate liquidity in the market and it's all for the buyers? Or is it the other way around? Willing to allow things to happen as long as it doesn't impact the creditor. If the creditor is impacted, then we won't allow it to go through. So over here, where the creditor is not impacted, we allow it to go through. Now, ibailu, ishtadaf b'nei chari, if you have free and clear property that got ruined, it got flooded, it got ruined, ma'o d'litrof mibishabde, can you go after the encumbered property? Can you go after the people who purchased it beforehand? The buyer purchased property, and he left behind free and clear property, and he basically says to the creditor when he comes to take the property from him, I left you sufficient space to collect from. Problem is, the space that he left now is ruined. It got flooded, something happened to it, and the creditor can't go after that property. Can the creditor now go after the buyer's property, even though the buyer left sufficient room for the creditor afterwards? So again, it really comes down to the question that we posed about the takana. If it was not for the way that I formulated the takana, which the Bnei Yeshua does, then you would not have a question over here. It'd be very clear that the creditor should be able to go after this property, or if you formulate it the other way, that the lokeach should be able to keep the property. Depending on which way you formulate it, it'd be very clear who has the primary rights over here. Is it the creditor or the buyer? Once you formulate the question as being exactly that, who are we protecting? Are we protecting the buyer or are we protecting the creditor? That's exactly the question over here. Here's a case where the buyer left sufficient property behind, but the creditor will be impaired by us invoking this takana. So now, who is our primary interest in protecting? Is our primary interest in protecting the lokeach? And therefore we say to the creditor, I'm sorry, you can't go after him because he left behind sufficient property. Or do we say that our primary goal is to protect the creditor, ensure that creditors get paid back? In this case, the creditor is being impaired by us protecting the lokea. So therefore, we won't do it. So tashma. Kot of the Rishon, v'lo chatmalo. L'sheni, v'chatmalo. Our braita that we said before, in the case where he sells property the first one and she does not sign off on it, the husband sells property the second one and she does sign off on it, ibda ktubata. She loses her ktuba, divrei Rabbi Meir. If you say over here that When a person has free and clear property left behind, you may not go after encumbered property. Nehi de ibdak tubata misheni. Okay, maybe she lost her right to collect from the second one. Mirishon mi atigbi. At least she should have the right to go after the first one. The fact that she released person number two should make it the equivalent as if that property got flooded. And when that property gets flooded, she's then allowed to go back up the chain and go after the earlier buyer of property. If you tell me that when the free and clear property gets ruined, or the second buyer's property got ruined, that you can go back now and chase after the first buyer, then this woman in a case where she can't go after the second buyer because she sold that right of lien to him, then she should have the ability to go after the first buyer. Why don't we let her go after the first buyer? Because the first buyer says, I left you room after I purchased it. So that would be the answer to our question. Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak ma'ibda. So Rav Nachman Yitzchak solves the problem by saying that you misunderstood the word ibda. We before read this, and when I explained the bright before, I said ibda means that she lost her ketubah from the first, and she lost her ketubah from the second. She lost her ketubah from the second because she relinquished her rights. She lost her ketubah from the first one because we said that he can always say, I left behind property, you can't come after me. But that's a misreading of it. My ibda, ibda misheni. She only lost her rights to the ketubah from the second buyer, but she still can go after the first buyer. Rabbi Meir says she just doesn't have a right with regards to the second buyer because she released those rights. But she can now go after the first buyer. So you can't prove anything from this braita, because it depends how you read the word ibda. If you read the word ibda that she lost her rights from both parties, then you'd have your answer that you're not allowed to go after an earlier lokeach when the later land gets ruined. If you read it that she only lost her rights of ketubah from the second buyer, then that would indicate that you could go back to the first buyer. So Amar Rava, shtei tshuvot b'davar. I have two answers to your assumption, Rav Nachman, and I'm telling you, you're wrong. The fact that you just said that ibda means only from the second, that's incorrect. Chado, the ibda the gamrei mashma. First of all, the word ibda normally means completely. You don't play around with the word ibda to say, oh, it means from the second, not the first. It should say that. If it doesn't say that, ibda means you lose your ketubah. We're not referencing the land pieces, we're referencing her ketubah. When it says ibda, the reference is to her ketubah, she lost her ketubah. Va'od, tanya. In addition to that, I have a braita. Lava min ha'echad, he borrows money from one. Umachar nechasav l'shtayim. And then he goes ahead and sells all of his property to two parties. So over here, he took out a loan. So the creditor has the primary lien on all of his property. After that, he sells his property to two buyers. V'kata bal chov l'lokeach sheni. And the creditor says to the second buyer, dinu dvarim in li'imcha. I'm releasing my lien from your property. Whatever agreement they came to, he releases his lien to the second buyer. Ein lo al lokeach rishon klum. He has no rights now to go after the first buyer. Mipnei sheyachol lomar einachta lecha makom legavot emenu. Because I left behind space for you to collect from. Buyer number one can always say, listen, I left property behind that buyer number two bought, and you can't come after me because I bought it and I left you plenty of room to collect. Your lien is not strong enough to come after me because you have rights to go after that second property and you have to go after him. Oh, you relinquished your rights? Too bad. Same thing as the flooding field. That's what the Gemara is saying now. Just because the assets became impaired doesn't mean you can go back after the earlier buyer over here. Your lien was on that property that you left behind. Now, we have an answer of the Gemara. Question is, who's making this statement? Rashi claims this is a continuation of Rava's statement, which is, Hotam iud afsid nafshei biyadayim. This is what you wanted to say before with regards to the woman, that this is a case is different. The case is different because you're causing your own loss. According to Rashi, both in the instance of the halva'a over here, and the case of the loan, you impaired yourself. The creditor, by releasing the lien to the second party, he caused his own problem. It wasn't that there was some sort of exogenous variable natural disaster that came and ruined the field. You relinquished your rights to collect on that field. Once you do that, you impaired your rights. You can't go after the first buyer because you caused the problem yourself. And similarly by the woman. When she releases her right to collect her ketubah from the second buyer, she caused herself the problem. That's the way Rashi reads it. Rashi reads this answer of the Gemara as being an answer for both of the two previous cases. Number one, the case of the Braita, which is that Braita is not necessarily a proof about the flooding of the field, but more importantly, it's answering the question about the woman. Why is it by the woman that we don't have a proof to the flooding fields? The answer is Rava speaking up and saying these cases are different. These cases are cases where the person, the creditor, impaired himself. That doesn't mean by a case of a natural disaster or flooding that that's going to be the answer. That's the way Rashi reads it. Tosafot says, Rava's statement ends before the Gemara says, Hotam. Rava just comes to undermine Rav Nachman's explanation, and he gives proofs to it. Then the Gemara comes along and answers, Hotam iud afsid nafshei biyadayim. That over there, he impaired himself, he caused the problem for himself. And as Tosafot points out, that means that the Gemara is only answering the braita that Rava brought. But that means back by the case of the Tubat Isha, that would not be applicable. Why not? She impaired herself over there as well. Why is that different than the case of the loan? So Tosafot distinguishes between the cases and says, by the case of the creditor, he had an open claim right now. His lien was in effect at this moment, and he had rights of collection at this moment. So therefore, when he wrote off the second guy and said, you're free of the lien, he impaired himself. The woman is not certain that she will ever be a creditor in this estate. It's very possible that she will predecease her husband, and then she will have no rights of collection whatsoever, because then you have Ketubat Benin Zichrin, which can't be taken from encumbered property. So if she predeceases her husband, then there won't be anything to deal with. Or if she gets divorced and her husband pays her off in cash, there may be that she never has to come after this property. So therefore, when she releases the property, it's not as if she is impairing herself. She's not even clear that this is going to be the method of collection or a factor at all. When she releases the other party or impairs herself, it's really in an uncertain circumstance. It's only a potential lien, and therefore when she releases it, we can't necessarily say that she impaired herself. So Tosafot comes to a different conclusion, which is that by the case of a creditor, he's impairing himself, and he won't have a right to go back to the earlier buyer. By a woman, she will have the right to go back to an earlier buyer, and it's a big nafka meaning between the way Rashi learns the Gemara and Tosafot learns the Gemara. Rashi learns that this is a continuation of Rava's statement, says that that's coming to answer the first question of the Gemara. Why isn't the case of Ketubot a proof? The answer is because Rava continues till the bottom line here, which is it's different. She impaired herself. According to Tosafot, the Gemara is coming to answer over here. Rava's bringing up the Braita, it's answering. It never goes back and deals with the case of Ketubot. And when Tosafot says that's a common practice in the Gemara to only answer the last question that they ask and not go back and answer all the questions that they ask. Therefore, according to them, they have a difference by a woman who is a creditor because of her ketubah or a future creditor because of her ketubah as to whether when she releases that, is that an impairment that we say, too bad, you impaired yourself? Or we say, no, she was uncertain, that's why she let it go. All right. Amale, Rav Yemar the Ravashi. Rav Yemar says to Rav Ashi, Vaha masim b'chol yom. Isn't this the common practice of courts today that the Dayanim say that when the later property gets ruined, we go after the earlier property? Dao Gavra, de Mishkan le Pardesa le Chavre. This individual gave as a mashkon, a pardes, whether it's an orchard or a vineyard, to his friend, le Eser Shnin, for 10 years. It's called a mashkanta de Sura. Mashkanta de Sura is that the payback of the loan is done in such a manner by which the collateral that is given to the creditor not only is collateral, but it's also a way to defease the loan. The creditor, while he has the collateral, will also eat the produce of the land during that period of time. And so therefore, that will defease the loan that is there and not just be collateral to the creditor. Because otherwise, it would be rebeat. If he kept the collateral and then he took the production of the land during that period of time, then he basically would be taking effective interest on the loan by taking the produce from the collateral. But if he uses that amount to pay off the loan and then returns the collateral afterwards, which is basically the way that Mashkanta de Sura works, is you have it for a fixed number of years, you keep the production for those years and that pays down the loan, and then the property reverts back to the debtor. So that's the scenario that we're talking about here. Is the debtor gave this property up to the creditor in order to pay down the loan. Vikash the Chamesh Nin. And after 5 years, the vineyard went dry. It stopped producing. So now the creditor is not getting his loan paid off. Only half of his loan got paid off because the collateral that he took now ran out. V'atel the Kamayu the Rabbonon. He came to the Rabbonon and said, as a creditor, I need to get my money out of the debtor. And now the methodology of payment is not working. Vikatvule Tirfa. And they wrote him a document to go after the properties of the debtor. That's even though the debtor sold this property to other people, and the other debtors say, we left you room to collect. You had this mashkon, you had this collateral that you were using. We left you plenty of room to collect your loan from. So how can you come after us now? Mara says, Atam Nami, that case as well is Inu the Afsid Anafshayu. They caused the loss to themselves. Now here we're talking about the buyers. The buyers caused the loss to themselves. Kevin Dabiyade the Pradesa Abid the Kish, Loi Bailay the Mizban. Since they know that that's a plausibility here, that the creditor who took this mashkon and was getting paid off through the production of this mashkon, they should know that there's a potential for the thing to dry up and not be good. So when the buyer comes, he can't say, I left you room to collect, because that room is a room that has potential to get ruined. And therefore, he has to leave even more room for him to collect. And that's why the creditor can go after them here. So the Gemara is maintaining their position that only where you actively caused yourself the loss do we say that your rights are impaired. But in cases where you did not actively cause yourself the loss, then your rights are not impaired. V'hilchaton, the halacha is, ishtodav b'nei chare tarfa mimishabde. And obviously this is the halacha because the Gemara is leaning heavily in this direction, which is, in a case where the free and clear property gets ruined, we will go back after the encumbered property or we'll go after the buyers. So even though they left sufficient room for the creditors to collect from, if that collateral, in a sense, if those liens do not pan out because something happened to the property, as long as it's not the creditor themselves impairing their rights, then we will say you can then go back after the earlier buyers. So even though technically the buyers are protecting themselves, they have to know that there is this remote potential that if something happens to this land for whatever reason, that they could come after them. Obviously, it's a significantly diminished possibility, and therefore they might buy it anyway because it's a risk worth undertaking. In a case where the creditor could come after them in any instance, then they wouldn't buy the land because it would really be too risky. Because that means that any loan that preceded them, even if they left sufficient assets to pay off the loans, they could come after them. According to Rashi, by the woman, this would be the same din, which is that she wrote up her rights to the second party. She can't go after the first party because Afshid and Afshayu. She caused the problem to herself. She impaired her rights to herself. According to Tosafot, she could go back after the first creditor in that case because maybe that's not considered to be impairment because of the uncertainty when she relinquished her rights. Amar Abaye, Nechasai Lech Vacharayech Leploni. It's talking about an individual who gives as a gift to a woman, not necessarily his wife. It's almost certain that it's not his wife over here. He gifts the property to this woman and says, I create a remainder trust, which is that you are allowed to use the property, and whatever remains in the trust afterwards goes to so-and-so. He creates this remainder trust where the woman is the beneficiary in the interim. We're not sure what that means. We don't know what that means now. But whatever's left over after this woman is through with it, meaning when she passes away, then will go to the person named as the remainder trust, this plony. Va'amda minisait. And then in the interim, she gets married. Baal lokeach havi. The husband is the equivalent of a purchaser. Because once the woman gets married to this individual, he becomes, in a sense, the co-owner of all of our property. He now has rights in this property. So the husband is deemed to be a buyer over here. Ve'en acharayech b'magom baal klum. And therefore, the person who's named in the remainder trust has no rights left. Because basically, what the woman did was sell all the property in the trust. She sold all the property in the trust, and now the buyer is the husband. So now the buyer has rights to hold on to that property, and the person named in the remainder trust can't come after that, because ein lachrayim v'mkom baal klum. Come on, who is this like? Who's the authorship of this statement like? Ki haitano. It's like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, D'Tanya. Nechasai lech v'acharayach l'ploni. Again, the same scenario where he grants a gift to a woman, and then there's a remainder trust. Yerad arishon u'machar. If the first individual goes ahead and sells, Hashini motzi miyad alukuchot, Dibre Rabbi. Rabbi says the remainder trust has super rights over here, and therefore the person named in the remainder trust is the one with the first lien on the property, and he can go after the buyers that bought it from the first person named in this trust and say that the gift was granted to her with a condition built into it. The condition is that you leave over this property to the other party when you're done with it. Basically what you said before, according to Rabbi, he only gifted her the peirot. He only gifted her the output of this land, but the rights to the land belong to the remainder trust, the person who's named in the remainder trust. And therefore, if she sells in the interim, fine. As long as she's alive, that will remain intact. But after she dies, The person who is entitled to the remainder trust can come and take the property and say, it's my property. That's exactly what a remainder trust is. A remainder trust says, the person named in the remainder trust only gets what's left over by the first party named here. So if she sells it, there will be nothing left. And then there will be no remainder trust. Remainder trust is only as good as the first person who received it, because the first person who received it has full rights. And if she sells it, so be it. Then the remainder will not go to this person that's named, this plony that's named there. So obviously, Abaye is saying this in Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, which is when she gets married and the husband is equivalent of a buyer, the person who is named in the remainder trust will have no rights to come and take it away from the buyer, like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Mar says, Umi amar Abaye hochi. Did Abaye really say this? V'amar Abaye. Didn't Abaye say, Ezehu Rasha Rum? Who is this? Naked Rasha means a terrible Rasha. That's someone who advises a party to sell out the property before the person named in the remainder trust can collect from it. Basically, monetize everything in this gift, because if you don't do that, it's all going to go to the other party named in the trust. If you give advice like that to someone, that's terrible. Don't do that, because that's obviously not the intent of the deceased. The person here granted the gift clearly granted it with the intent that it goes to the party afterwards. If you go and sell it in the interim, then in a sense you're defeating the point of the remainder trust. And if you advise someone to do that, it's even worse. If Abaye says that, then how come over here we're telling this woman when she can go get married, and then the remainder trust will be ruined? Mar says, wait a minute, how can you compare the cases? Mi kamar tina say, we're not advising the woman to go out and get married. It's the natural way of the world. A woman will get married. And since she will get married, the husband, it comes to me, lokeach. It's not that we're advising her to go get married. It's just that she will get married. And by the way, the grantor of the gift should have known that. Granted the gift, when he granted it, is aware of the fact that this woman likely will get married. If she gets married, then her husband's going to be the first rights to this land. He'll be like a purchaser, and then there'll be no remainder trust left. So that's how we reconcile these two statements of Abaye. V'amar Abaye, nechsai leich, v'acharayich leploni. Again, in a case where he grants the property to this woman and says, after you, there's this remainder trust for this party. Umachra umeta. She sells it and then dies. Habal motzi miyad l'chuchot. The baal, the husband over here, can take it away from the buyers. Ve'acharayich miyad baal. And then the person in the remainder trust can take it away from the husband. Ve'lokeach. And the purchaser, miyad acharayich, can take it out from the person that is the remainder trust. Ukmina l'kulu biyad lokeach. Over here, we don't keep going circular. We leave it with the purchaser. So now, what happened in this scenario is, you had the trust that was gifted to this woman, and the woman went ahead and sold it. And when she sells it, the husband, in a sense, has a veto right, because he's the inheritor of his wife. So his wife, who had this property, she sold this property, she's only to sell her rights to the property. She can't sell the husband's rights in the property. So now, the husband's rights here are that he inherits his wife. So if he inherits the wife, then the principal should come to him. So he goes ahead and says to the buyer, listen, my wife sold it to you, but she only had a right to sell it to you if I predeceased her, because then she owned the property. Now that she predeceased me, I'm the inheritor of her property. She sold it to you for the interim period, but now, it's my property. I want it back. And this would be a scenario even without the remainder trust. The husband could go after the buyers because she sold something that didn't belong to her. Had he predeceased her, it would have belonged to her and the sale would have gone through. But over here, where she predeceased him, he's the inheritor of her land. He could go after the buyer, so he does that. But then, the party to the remainder trust comes along and says, wait a minute, the gift was given to your wife as long as she was alive. When she dies, I'm the inheritor. So the remainder trust comes and says to the husband, it's mine now. So he takes it. Then the buyer goes in and says, wait a minute, that's only a remainder trust if there wasn't a buyer in the interim. I bought it in the interim. Since I bought it in the interim, it's mine. So we send it back to the lokeach. Remainder trust doesn't exist. So now, in this scenario, the real question is, why is the husband not deemed to be a lokeach over here? In the first scenario, Abaye said that the husband is deemed to be a lokeach, and therefore the remainder trust has no rights there. On the other hand, over here, the remainder trust comes and takes it away from the baal as if he's not a lokeach. Why is that in this case? That's a stira in Abaye's position, the solution to which will be your question that you asked before. So there are two questions over here. One question is, the Stira and Abaye. The other question is, how come this is different than our Mishnah? In our Mishnah, we keep going around and around and around until they come to some sort of agreement between them. Over here, we say it stops at the Lokeach. We don't say it keeps going around. So that's what Gemara says. Mishnah Mahadatan, how is this different than our Mishnah? Because Rod Chalila, Aichi Asup Shara, Beneim. Gemara says, that's because Hotam Iluhub Seda Lukuhu. In our Mishnah, every party is a loser. Every party is a loser because the creditor extended a loan, and now he won't get paid back. The woman has her ktubah. She's a creditor. She's entitled to her ktubah. She won't get paid out on her ktubah. The lokeach, the buyer of the field over there, expended money to buy the field. So in that instance, every one of the parties has a claim, and if their claim is not fulfilled, they lose. They lose money. So over there, we keep going around until they work out some sort of monetary solution between them. Hocha, over here, lokeach hu deitleib seida. There's only one party here that expended money. There's only one loser over here. The woman who got it, that was a gift. It was a matanatar. The husband inheriting to it is also a gift because he got it from his wife. He didn't pay for it. The remainder trust is also a gift. It wasn't that he put up money for it. It was just that somebody gifted it to him as a remainder trust. The only person that put up money here was the buyer. And he will lose if we don't give it to him. So in this case, we say we favor the buyer because he's the only one who expended money. He's the only one who will be out if we don't. So therefore, we protect him. And it doesn't keep going around. We leave it with the lokeach. Now, in all of these cases where it goes around and around and around, many of the Rishonim point out, it's not literally that we keep going around, they keep grabbing it from each other. We acknowledge the reality that that's what's going to happen. And since that's what's going to happen, we work it out. So it's over here. Not that we have to take it away, that the husband takes it from the lokeach. Then the remainder trust takes it from him, and then the lokeach takes it back from him, and we stop there. But then why did they do that whole first scenario? You could have left it with the lokeach in the first place. That's what Tosafot says. No, they don't literally do it. They just, let's see what's going to happen if we do this. And the answer is that we're going to leave it with the lokeach, so we'll leave it with the lokeach. But not that we literally do that. And same thing with our Mishnah. It's not that literally they keep going around and around in circles, but rather that they acknowledge that that will be the scenario. And acknowledging that will be the scenario, they agree to come to some sort of monetary agreement between them. Azal Raf Ravam, Amar L'Shmaita Kamei de Ravashi. He said this over to Ravashi. And he says, Mi Amar Abayi Ochi. Did Abaye really say this? This is what we pointed out. There's a steer in Abaye's statements. V'amar Abaye, nechasai leich, v'acharayach leploni, amdavin iseit, balokeach avi. The husband is a purchaser. V'ein lachrayach lekom bal klum. And therefore, remainder trust has no rights over here because the Baal bought it already. So you see here, in one case, Abaye is deeming the Baal as a lokeach, and therefore there's no remainder trust. And in the case that we just brought down, he's saying that the remainder trust has rights over the husband. He's not considered to be a lokeach. What's the difference? Amalei, otam damar la kashi pnuya. The difference is exactly what you pointed out, David, which is, in the first scenario, she was single when the gift was given to her. So therefore, when she gets married, the husband is deemed to be a buyer. Because the gifter of the property to her knew that she was going to get married. And the fact that he knew that she was going to marry, he knows that means that the husband is going to become a buyer over here, and the husband's going to exert rights over the property. Hocha, in this latter case, where Abaye says the Baal is not deemed to be a lokeach, and the remainder trust gets it, he granted her the gift when she was married already. When she's already married, what is he saying to this woman? By the fact that he set up a remainder trust, knowing that she's married already, means that he's clearly gifting it without rights to the husband. He's saying that it's going to you, and your husband has no rights in it, and he's not considered to be a lokeach, it's going directly to the remainder trust. That's why he set up the remainder trust when she's married. So while she's married, he can make that claim, because he knows that the husband's there, and despite the husband being there, he says it's not going to your husband, it's going to the other party, and that he can do. In the case where she's not married, there's no husband in the picture. But he knows that this woman will get married, and therefore he has to assume that the husband will be a lokeach in that instance. And that's the difference in the two positions of Abaye. B'chein Balchov, and similarly Balchov, a creditor, this is the last cases in the Mishnah. What does it mean, similar? What's the case? Tana, b'chein Balchov, u'shnei lekuchot. The case we have a creditor, and then two buyers. Two buyers from the debtor. Rashi claims that each one is half of the loan. So say the creditor had an outstanding loan of 100. The debtor has two fields. Each field is worth 50. So he sells field worth 50 to buyer number one. And he sells a field worth 50 to buyer number two. And then the creditor releases buyer number two. So he releases buyer number two and says, I won't come and claim from you. So what happens is, the creditor then goes after buyer number one. How is he allowed to go after buyer number one if he released buyer number two? Buyer number one can always say, I left you property. And we saw before that when you impair your rights, you don't have the ability to go after the first creditor. Over here, that's not the case, as Rashi points out, because his loan is the value of both pieces of the land. And therefore, he has a right to go after both buyers over here, because there wasn't sufficient property left behind by the first buyer. The first buyer only left 50 behind, which is a loan of 100. So therefore, he goes after the first buyer, and he takes the property. Buyer number one says, you know what? The debtor sold me this property with recourse. Well, he sold with recourse. That means I have priority over buyer number two. Buyer number two, hand me your property. I'm the one with the first lien over here. So you get buyer number two gives buyer number one the property. You know what the creditor does? The creditor goes and takes that property as well. But the creditor wrote to buyer number two, I have no rights against you. So then buyer number two comes and says, give me the property back. I want these properties back because you have no rights to collect when it's going to impair me. Circular. It's going around and around again. That's the same case in the Mishnah that Bechein Pshara, that's Bechein over there, that you do have to do a monetary agreement between them to stop the property from moving around from party to party. Bechein Isha Balat Chov v'shnei lekuchot. In the same scenario where the woman owns a ketubah, and the land that was sold is only sufficient to cover the ketubah. So the two pieces of land together, they are sufficient for the ketubah. And he sold to buyer number one half and buyer number two second half. And she released buyer number two. So again, you have the same scenario. Many of the Rishonim ask, why do you have to give me the two cases? They're the exact same case. They're different than our Mishnah. Because in our Mishnah, you're talking about two women that are claimants versus case here where there's only one creditor, but there are two buyers. So that scenario is different. But you could have brought me a Baal Chov. How is a woman with a ketubah any different than a Baal Chov? So many of the Rishonim say, it was unnecessary. You're right. Ain't Ochanami. It's a duplication. The Gemara just mentioned a creditor and a woman with a ketubah who is equivalent to a creditor, but not that there's any Kiddush. Tosafot, on the other hand, here says, there is a reason to differentiate between a woman with a ketubah and a creditor. And it goes through the reasons why you might have thought a creditor has more rights or less rights, or why you might have thought a woman has more rights or less rights. And therefore, the Mishnah had to come and state explicitly by both cases that we say the same thing, that the scenario is the same both by a creditor as well as by a woman. Okay, with that, we complete the 10th parak. Hadran alach, Misha nasui. Right, we'll just start with the Mishnah, and then we'll move on with the Gemara tomorrow. Amana nizonet minichsei yitomim. A widow is allowed to take her sustenance out of the estate. Where her husband passes away, and she's left with the estate, she has a right over here to get her sustenance, her mizonot, out of the estate. Maseyada shilahem. The only trade-off is that her output, her production, will belong to the yitomim. That's the quid pro quo. She's going to take mizonot out of the estate. While she's alive, her husband provides her mizonot. She provides him maseyadayim. So the same thing is true post the death of her husband. She's going to take mizonot out of the estate. She has to contribute her maseyadayim into the estate. The Gemara will ask over here, who gets the choice? When we say that the almanah is allowed to be sustained out of the estate, is that the almanah's choice? Or is that the yitomim's choice? Can the yitomim say, go ahead, stay with us, just give us your maseyadayim? You can say to her, listen, we're paying out your ketubah, you're out of here. Or is it her choice? As long as she doesn't collect her ketubah, she's allowed to take mizonot out of the estate. But if she takes her ketubah, she's not, but it's her choice. That would be the difference as to whether the girsa in the Mishnah is nizonet or hanizonet, as to whether she has the right or they have the right. And the Gemara will discuss that in the girsa of the Mishnah. And as Tosafot points out, there were Mishnayot that had a girsa of minichsei yitomim u'maseyadah shelahem. It was a vava chibur. Tosafot says there can't be a vava chibur, because if there was a vava chibur, it'd be obvious which way the girsa was in the Mishnah, because then it's saying u'maseyadah shelahem. Therefore, her output is theirs. Since she has the right, therefore, her maseyadayim are theirs. But if you don't have a vav there, then you can be goreis in either direction. And that's why Tosafot says there's no vav in the Mishnah. Vein chayavim bikvurata. The yitomim are not responsible for her burial, because yorshei ketubata chayavim bikvurata. Because her inheritors, I mean the ones who inherit her ketubah, they are the ones that are responsible for her burial. We saw this earlier with regards to a Yavam and a Yavama, in a case where she was left in limbo. The first brother died, but the second brother has yet to perform Yibum with her. She's in that limbo state, and therefore the Yorshea Av and the Yorshea Baal are fighting over the woman's property. And the Mishnah, we said over there, and now the Gemara was Medayek out of our Mishnah, exactly that,
that in that case, whoever is the inheritor of her ketubah will be responsible for her burial. And that's true during her lifetime as well, meaning that if she predeceases her husband is responsible for her burial because he inherits her. He inherits her ketubah. So too, after her husband's death, whoever is the beneficiary of her ketubah, they will be the ones who are responsible for her burial. Now, this is a big machloket rishonim as to how far that goes. Does that only apply where there is a ketubah and she does collect her ketubah? Then those individuals will be responsible for her burial? Or is it even in a case where there is no ketubah, but the fact that they had the potential to get her ketubah, that's enough to obligate them to bury her? So the difference will be, for instance, in a case where the assets of the estate are all metaltalin. It's all money. There's no karka. In that case, the woman will not be able to collect her ketubah, because the ketubah only has rights of collection on real property. Since she only has rights of collection on real property, even though the inheritors of a ketubah, technically, if there was real property here, would be able to inherit her, but because the estate is all metaltalin, and you can't take from metaltalin of Yitomim, therefore, the woman will not collect her ketubah. Who is responsible for a burial there? According to the Rishonim, it's like Tosafot, it's only in a case where they actually inherit her, they won't be responsible for a burial. But neither will the Yitomim be responsible for burial. That means that she'll have to be buried out of Kesef Tzedakah. It'll be on the seaboard to bury her because neither party over here is responsible. Not the Yitomim, because they don't inherit her ketubah, even though technically they're not paying out her ketubah, but they're not responsible for that. Her inheritors will not bury her because they're not inheriting anything. They're not getting anything from her. Therefore, they don't have to bury her. Other Rishonim say that it's just the potential to inherit is sufficient. You don't have to actually inherit. And therefore, her inheritors, even though they won't get anything here, and they will not inherit a ketubah, nevertheless, since they were the potential inheritors of a ketubah, they become the responsible parties, and they will have to bury her, even though they're getting no money, they're not getting anything for her ketubah. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Gemara on the bottom of Tzadihei Amud Bet.